Welcome back to Laravel Podcast Season 3, where I mispronounce everybody's names. Today I'm talking to Abed Halawi. I think that's right. He did lots of great packages and stuff. You'll learn more soon. Okay, bye. All right, welcome back to another episode of Laravel Podcast Season 3, where I mispronounce people's names. I actually got it wrong right before the intro, but then he corrected me. So it's the syllable, it's the emphasis on the wrong syllable. So I'm talking to Abed Halawi, and I'm going to let him introduce himself, where he's from. And I tell you guys all this every single time when I do this, but I'd like to switch it up between people that you have heard of before. You know an Adam and you know a Taylor and you know whatever, and people who within certain communities, they're well known. They made an amazing package. They're a strong community leader or something, but the whole rest of the world might not know about them. So, you know, this is the guy I'm talking to today is a little bit more than that second one. So I want him to tell us a real quick bit about, so who are you? Where do you live? Where do you work? And what are a few things that you're known for, you know, in your world?
All right. So you got my name almost right this time.
Almost. I'll take it.
it's Abed Halawi in our language. In English, usually it's Abed Halawi. So the emphasis is on the middle of the last name.
So when you say it's the emphasis is on the last syllable of your last name, Halawi. Not Halawi.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I'm getting there. Sorry, go ahead.
So I live in Beirut. I was born here and always been here. And I currently work here as well at a company called Vinelab. What we do is focus on the influencer marketing, building a SaaS platform to provide influencer marketing to brands. Basically, our website says it all, so if you'd like to know more about that, go to vinelab.com and that will tell you everything about that. So I'm here because mainly about the Lucid architecture, which was first introduced in LataCon EU. The Lucid architecture is about a collection of experiences that we've went through. And we thought that certain ways would improve the way we work together as a team. And we thought that, well, actually, this is something very interesting and could help others solve their problems as well, the same problems that we've had and solved our way. So maybe our way could help others solve theirs as well. That's one thing. And the other thing is NeoEloquent, which is the package for Eloquent and Neo4j. Neo4j is the graph database. And we use that library as the core storage library in our products with which we bridge between Laravel projects and graph databases.
So there's a couple things you said there. So if anybody was at LaraCon EU, you would have seen Abed give his talk, was it 2 years ago, 2017? Or that was 1 year ago,
yes.
I guess. Math is hard. But also make sure I put a link to that in the show notes. So he mentioned that, and then also he mentioned he maintains and created a package called NeoEloquent, which is a kind of an Eloquent style wrapper on top of Neo4j. And if you ever heard anybody talk about graph databases, it's one of those things where, oh my gosh, graph databases are the new hotness, but I think a lot of people don't actually have a lot of experience working with them. So real quick, before we get into your backstory, I'd love for you to give me a tiny little pitch in each of those. And I don't know if you're familiar with the phrase elevator pitch, but it basically means, imagine you have 30 seconds on an elevator ride to convince a potential user or founder or funder or something like that of why your thing's great. Can you give me the elevator pitch, the 30-second pitch on Lucid architecture? Why is it different? What does it help you with? And then I want to get the same one for Neo4j and graph databases.
All right. No pressure, huh?
None at all.
So, so Lucid. It's about eliminating legacy projects completely. You would never have to move to a project that you've worked on 3 years ago and say, where does this go? Where is this piece of code that I'm looking for? Where do I find this happening? Or how is this feature implemented? What's the structure of the code? All of these are eliminated with the Lucid architecture, which basically takes over from where MVC leaves off.
What's the one biggest difference with how Lucid architecture organizes its code relative to your normal MVC project?
It complements MVC projects. So it's not a replacement to MVC, but basically with MVC, in the controller, you almost have everything. This is where things get a little confusing in controllers. I mean, if you have a project A and you have a project B, to each by a different separate team, in the controller, if you go there, you will find things written differently. And this is where Lucid comes in. What Lucid says that each controller method only has one line only. This line is to serve a specific feature. A feature specifically is a class by itself. And within that feature, you would define the sequence of steps that accomplishes this feature, and we call them in Lucid jobs. So each step in the feature is a job, and each job does only one thing and is responsible for performing one thing only. You can share jobs between different features, but each job can do only one thing, and each feature serves one user story from the controller. That way we can achieve what we always dream about achieving with MVC, which is the thinnest controllers we can ever reach.
Mm-hmm. Is it similar to invocable controllers, or do your controllers have multiple methods, but each of those methods only have one line?
You can say it's close to what a command bus pattern is. Mm-hmm. So you can think of your controller as the command bus, and you're just executing commands.
Got it.
Commands take different forms, right? It could be a feature or it could be a job. So the same form repeats itself.
Got it. Okay. And if anybody wants to learn more, it's all written up in the... Well, it's both written up in the GitHub, which I'll link, but it's also in your Laracon EU talk, which is on YouTube, and I'll link that one as well. But since this is not an architecture podcast at the moment, it's a person podcast, let's move on real quick to talk about NeoEloquent. So NeoEloquent, I understand, gives an Eloquent-style interface to Neo4j. If you had to give the elevator pitch again, this time, can you give me a quick elevator pitch for graph databases and what makes them a little bit different from traditional relational databases?
Sure. So with graph databases, the way we store the data and visualize the data and manipulate the data is the same way we think about the data. So the first thing we do when we start a new project or data modeling for a project, what we do is draw circles and connections between these circles, which later on gets translated and transformed into tables and foreign keys, etc. But with graph databases, the way you draw the first data model with your hand on a board is the way it is stored right away. Mm-hmm. And you can manipulate that.
Okay.
And you can also implement traversal and all the graph algorithms that we study about throughout our computer science journey. So you can apply all of these to the data that is stored.
And if anybody like me does not have a computer science background, when we're talking graphs, the easiest way to kind of think about that is when people talk about a social graph, to think about everything being based on relationships on relationships on relationships. So
exactly. And a relationship is what we call the first class citizen in the database.
Right. Whereas with relational databases, it's a little more second class, essentially.
Exactly.
Foreign keys and everything. Okay, cool. Well, I'd love to talk more about those things, but today ain't the day for that. So I want to know a little bit about you. So before we go into your backstory, I'd like to know, first of all, when you meet somebody at the supermarket and they ask you what you do, what do you tell them?
These days, I find it very easy to talk about these things from how it used to be when we first started, because today, especially with today's generation, we take technology for granted, right? Mm-hmm. They're born and growing up in the world where cloud is the norm,
right?
So if I were to explain this, I would maybe go to an example by saying, okay, I'm a robot, and you tell me what I do, what to do, and I will do everything you tell me. So this is how it first starts. So right. When they tell me to do this and do that, I would do them. And then I would say, well, this is exactly what I do with machines. So I would give instructions to machines so that they run them when I'm not there. So they keep doing them.
So what is your actual role? Are you a developer? Are you a tech lead? What's your official title?
My official title is tech lead.
Okay.
But we're a startup.
Okay.
This is
a little bit of everything.
Exactly.
You can call yourself CTO if you wanted, right?
Yeah, exactly. The thing is, we with startups, mostly we get the opportunity to wear different hats, mm-hmm. which is interesting, so that we can get horizontal and vertical expertise.
Yeah.
So by horizontal, I mean different technologies, different areas of technologies, say front-end, back-end, DevOps, and everything related to that. And in each area, we get to grow vertically, where we improve ourselves and our skills in each of these areas. This is the most interesting about being in a startup.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned having a computer science degree, so I want to hear a little bit later about the path you took from computer science degree up to being a part of a startup. Real quick, were you one of the founders of the startup, or did you join it after it started?
I'm not the founder, but I'm the first employee.
All right, so you're employee number one. So we'll talk a little bit about your journey from graduating a computer science degree to being employee number one of a startup. But real quick, when did you first get into computers?
I was very young, basically around. I was 9 years old, maybe 10 years old, and our neighbor had a computer, and I used to go there just to watch them play. They did not allow me to play.
Right.
My brother used to play instead. but later on, I had my own computer at home, but with no internet, so Encyclopedia was our way to go to search for information back then, and mostly gaming. So we were kids. I enjoyed gaming mostly.
What kind of games did you play?
My introduction to gaming. Mostly fight games, first-person shooter.
Yeah.
Yeah, Delta Force and, these games.
Yeah, for sure.
And also strategy. Yeah. Like Edge of Empires, Red Alert, the early kinds
Man,
of, the early
of
versions
Alert.
Of those. But then later, the reason why I joined or took the computer science path was a bit of a coincidence.
Okay.
Kind of. Because at first I was into medicine, so I wanted to be a doctor at first. And I went to the university where I started studying that for a year. But after half of that year passed, I did not find myself there. I felt that I'm not doing what I'm supposed to be doing. And the thing is, I passed all my exams and passed everything, and I was doing good.
Sure.
But then later on, I couldn't feel it. It's just that thing you get at a later stage of doing a thing for a while.
Yep.
And then you say, I don't feel like doing this my entire life.
Yeah.
Mainly because I was interested in neurology and everything related to the human brain and human mind, and has a kind of a minor to psychology. That's a side interest. But at some point, I decided to shift majors, and I was looking at what universities are in the area that are close by, and so a software engineering class by mistake, basically, because I was looking at a different area of courses, and there was software engineering, and I was like, what is software engineering? I didn't know what that was. So I went in, and I saw a lot of things that had to do with computers, and I thought, well, that would tell me how these games have always worked. What's interesting is that I'm going to jump a little forward to say that with computer science, I found myself finding out about how humans operate and psychology specifically more than I think I could have with medicine, because the amount of people who are using technology today can tell you a lot about how it has changed the way we live. It's everywhere, and it has changed almost every industry. So when you're in technology, it's not only about the code that we write, it's not only about having programs that are written just for the machine to work, but it's more about satisfying the human need. This is the essence of these things. And one thing that I had recently a small chat about, that has to do with how designers can get to know more about technology, and how technologists or developers get to know more about design and maybe do them themselves. And the way I like to think about it is that designers don't need to know technology or development, and developers don't really need to know design and do it themselves. But it's the bridge between them lies in a different area. It's philosophy, it's psychology, it's the bridge between those two. So if these two areas can learn more about these, I think this will close a huge gap between these two areas.
You're reminding me a lot of my favorite conference talk I've ever given, which was about empathy. And I made a lot of the similar pitches from a little bit different angle that you're talking about, but that understanding people and satisfying people is the best way to be a good programmer is not to know the code better than everybody else. It's to know the end user better than anybody else. And to empathize both with end users and also the other developers on your team and the designers and everything like that. So I love where you're going there. And I moved from working in a nonprofit where my job was about people and understanding people and helping people grow to running a company. And there's a lot more similarity than I would have expected between the two, because I'm still working with people and helping people grow and helping people do a good job. You know, so I couldn't agree with you more about that. And I love hearing you say that.
Exactly.
You're not the first person to say this. I one of my most recent interviews, I can't remember exactly who it was, said that same thing of, you know what, I wanted to figure out how the games work. And so that's really fascinating to me. So you got in, did you find yourself in there saying, oh, this is amazing, I love this, this is so great? Or did you get in there and did you have a moment of being kind of dissatisfied where you said, oh, well, I thought it was going to be fun and games all the time and all I'm learning is math? What was your actual experience in those computer science classes?
At first, I did not know what to expect. Mm-hmm. I did not know what computer science was all about, right? So with that in mind, I started learning by myself on the side, mm-hmm. besides what I was being taught at the university. I was very interested in the field. I did not expect to learn everything on the first day, right? So with that expectation in mind, I started finding out that I'm good at this. Nice. It's all about recognizing patterns, yeah. Right? I really did not care about where I'm putting most of my effort, because I know that everything that is being taught and channeled to us as students is to orient us towards having a certain mindset, so that at some point in the future, we know where to use these techniques and methodologies. It was a bit later in my studies, maybe it was the second year of university, that I've discovered that university will not teach you everything. Right? It was right. Maybe it was a little late for that, but I knew then that this is not the place that will teach you everything, but what they will do is teach you how to think about problem solving, how to think about the computer science and how programming works. It's just the basics and fundamentals. You don't really need to learn every computer language and every technology out there from university. They just put you on the path and it's all up to you in terms of where to go and how to take this further.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. So you did that. Were you having to choose to specialize in a particular type of programming and everything like that? Or did you just, you got a degree in software engineering or computer science and then you were out in the workplace and had to find something? Like what was the next big decision you had to make after you'd made the decision to go into computer science?
It was the second year also where I joined a company where I used to work as a support agent. You know, the regular things, tickets, answering tickets, forums, and answering the phone and doing and helping people get their job done on the platform. Mm-hmm. And at some point in there, as I was studying and working a full-time job, the technical department had a certain problem they were trying to solve, and I was overhearing. I wasn't very involved in their works, but as I was overhearing, and it was in the kitchen where I spent most of my time.
nice.
I overheard this problem they were having that had to do with data storage and transferring data from a place to another. I don't really remember the details of that problem, but I remember throwing out a word that helped them solve it, and then they were interested. So I was working on this Java project for the university, and one of the head of the developers came into the room and saw me coding at work, which I was not supposed to do. So he asked me, "Why are you coding? This is not your job here." And I said, "Well, I enjoy this. I like to do this when I don't have anything else to do." So it was then when he asked for me to join the development team and start learning web development. So it was kind of passive, the way I started learning about web development and the web technologies. But at the same time, I was enjoying doing it.
Yeah.
I enjoyed programming on my free time.
Mm-hmm.
And after moving there, the kind of choice I had to make was which area to fill. Because they had an area that had to do with software programming, installed software programming, and they had a web application programming, which was a portal that involved all the areas of the company. Mm-hmm. So this was the administration interface of everything that everyone does in the company. I was going through a revamp, and I had the chance to join this team who was doing this revamp. And I did not know anything about web development. So I started learning there,
uh-huh.
Right? It was very tough. That's the least I can say. Because back then, I don't remember there was much courses online to learn from. Mm-hmm. It was mostly either books or CDs that, I'm not proud to say this, but we had to get the cracked mm-hmm. version or the,
yep.
the pirated versions of those so that we can learn. This was basically my transition from being a support agent to starting to work in development.
Yeah.
From there on, it was a regular journey where I continued exploring this realm of technologies. So I started with front-end development, doing a little bit of JavaScript here and there. It was jQuery was booming at the time. So I started learning that, and I was very interested in animations on web. So it was some kind of an interest between design and implementation mm-hmm. of things. I like to see things move on an interface.
Yeah.
And with jQuery, I had the chance to do it with a very easy instruction. So that was the catch for me to say, well, I'm glad I chose this major. I'm glad that I'm here today. And that's definitely how I would like to spend my time.
That's very cool. So you were still in school when you were doing all this stuff? Wow.
Yes. Okay. Basically, I graduated.
Sleep?
Well, this I don't remember doing that. No.
Sorry, what were you saying about graduating?
Yeah. So I graduated. Basically, computer science to study it here, it takes 3 years, maybe four, with the regular courses. But it took me 5+. Because I was working full-time, so I started understanding that work will teach me much more about practicality than the university will. But still, I was very interested in the topics that were given at the university that had to do mostly with organizing work, everything that's related to diagrams, planning, software engineering, and how to organize the work. There was many non-tech courses that I was interested in as well. That has to do with management too. So I was learning a bit of both types of programming. So it was high level where I learned the web stuff, and it was low level where I learned the theories and everything that had to do with how a computer works, and behind the curtains.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very interesting. And then I graduated after 5 years with 3 years experience full time, which was at the time was wow. I was very happy to have done that.
Yeah.
It was one of the best choices I've ever made.
Okay. And so what was the road from there to being employee number one of your current startup? Was there a lot? There are a lot of different jobs in between there, or
no, not much actually. Okay. There was one failed startup that I founded in the university. So they had this program where they opened what they called the Innovation Center. Mm-hmm. It was a room for people who would like to build their ideas in there. Mm-hmm. They bring some students together, and if one of these ideas make it through certain specified competitions that they do across universities here, mm-hmm. You have to make it for the at least first three positions, and if you did, they would invest not money, but they would invest in helping you push this further.
Cool.
Right? Which is what you need at the time, right? As a student, that's all you need, a place to apply the work and an idea to put all the code in place. Mm-hmm. And that's the first thing after the first job. Then there was a job for a year where I also did a lot of web programming. I learned a lot of Linux there because I was handling also system administration.
Okay.
And then after that, I was here where I am today. It was interesting because when you're joining a startup, there's merely any guarantee that this is going to work.
Right.
And there's merely an idea based mm-hmm. on a certain gap in the market. And I can easily say that this has been almost 6 years. It will be 6 years in October. And I can easily say that we've pivoted a lot throughout these 6 years, and it's mm-hmm. been the best experience I've ever had from personal and technical. It wasn't only technical, because when I first started, I was the only developer, mm-hmm. and most of my time I was just coding. But then things started to grow, and as a company, we started to scale. So at the beginning, we were doing services. Mm-hmm. So with services, you get exposed to a variety of types of projects. Mm-hmm. So there were mobile projects, there were web projects, and there were things in between as well. So this variety created a lot of needs for the team to grow. And as the team grew, my role expanded as well. Mm-hmm. So I had to occupy a larger gap in the team and cover not only technical and coding, but it was mostly organization and management mm-hmm. to take over. And this was a real, what's the biggest word than challenge?
Yeah.
But I would say more than a challenge.
Yeah.
Because as a developer, all you would like to be doing and spending your time doing is coding, mm-hmm. right? But then if you code and not know where this code is going, mm-hmm. At some point, these things get lost. So we need to organize things. And what's interesting is that this led to creating the Lucid architecture, because as much as there were chaos in the development process that we were implementing at the time, we had this huge need to organize things, not only from personal and communicational perspective, but also in the code itself. We had so many projects running at the same time, and every time we switched between a project and another, it felt like going from a country to another. Mm-hmm. It felt like you were looking at something that's red, and then you're looking at something that's yellow, and then that's right. white, and then that's black. That's a huge difference between those. So this was the inception of Lucid, where it tries and makes sure that all these projects are normalized.
Mm-hmm. So that you felt some kind of chaos. You were switching contexts a lot, and the contexts were different enough that it felt too chaotic, and you had to relearn each one. So you created something that applies more of a standardization across projects than what MVC provides. And you said, now when I enter a new project, and obviously it's much more complicated than this, but I know that every single web request will be serviced by a single feature or job, basically. And you're trying to make it such that on every project, it uses the same architecture.
Exactly.
Have you had the opportunity to use it on a pretty significant diversity of projects, or is it still something pretty new for y'all?
We're currently using it So we're implementing microservices. Mm-hmm. And with microservices, each service we have is a Laravel installation of the Lucid architecture itself. Mm-hmm. And we currently have around 48 services running at the same time. So you can easily say that we've implemented Lucid in 48 projects.
Right.
And so are those far, and they're in production.
Are those 48 all serving the same primary product, which is the influencer-related stuff? Or is it a whole bunch of different products that are all kind of offered to influencers?
These 48 services are in the same product.
Okay.
It's the SaaS platform that we're building. On the side, we have some side projects that we use internally that are also based on Lucid. I would count two or three that are currently running, and they are all in production and okay. live.
I am going to ask.
So we're pretty confident.
I'm going to ask a few. You're good. It's a little bit of lag. Yeah. I'm going to ask a few questions about Lucid. I can tell you're confident. I can see it in your face and hear it in what you're saying. So since every single controller method, all it does is it just serves one of these features. A feature is then meant to specifically parse the request, which I assume it gets out of like the application container, and also return a result. So is it safe to say that a feature, or maybe a job, let's say a feature for now, is the same as a controller method in terms of its scope, in that it takes an HTTP request and returns an HTTP response?
It is exactly that.
Okay. So it's obviously more complicated, but the simplest way to think about it is when you're thinking about those 200 line long controller methods, pull that thing out and make it a class. That's the first step.
One class.
Yeah, so it's very interesting because I gave a talk at Laracon US that talked about, among other things, quite a few code patterns for how to simplify your 200 long controller methods. And I didn't talk about Lucid, but I talked about things you can extract so that those things in there are pulled out into individual classes. And what I kind of recommended more at that point was, well, here's a way to simplify the response part, using a custom HTTP response or something like that. Here's a way to simplify the input part by using custom HTTP requests or something like that. Here's a way to look at customize the database queries using repositories or whatever else. So I'm super interested to take a look at this and try it out. Are there any open source projects that are using Lucid?
I'm not aware of any. An open source project, as in a full Lucid project that is currently operating and is online. Okay.
Yeah, like if somebody wanted to go see what it looked like to use an actual functioning application using Lucid.
There's definitely an example that is on the GitHub repo. And there is work being put into having video tutorials that can teach Lucid in depth. But having a Lucid project online as an open source means basically that you're exposing the whole project. So that's interesting, though. I'd definitely like to implement something like that.
At Titan, we have a whole bunch of ideas that would never make any money, but we just like to provide them as a service, and so we open source their code. So if you one day say, you know what I'd really like? So I'd like a website that does X, Y, and Z for me, and only 500 people would use it, and those 500 people would never pay any money for it, or maybe they'd pay $10 a month for it, but it's not actually worth trying to do all the marketing. Maybe that might be an opportunity for you guys to actually have a real functioning website that has real users, that has to service real user requests, and everything is completely transparent. Because I think that's one of the most interesting ways to have these conversations and to expose our internal ideas to kind of the world around us and really kind of let them up to the light of criticism outside of our own organization. We have some ideas at Titan that sound good until they get exposed to the outside air. And I'm not saying that's going to happen with Lucid, but I that is something that's been super valuable for us. So.
I know, I would love if that would happen.
Cool.
Actually, that's a lovely idea. I would definitely invest into that.
Cool. Well, if I ever have an idea, I'll throw in your way, but I would say that that'd be a good selling point for you guys on Lucid to be able to have something like that people can really see. All right, so this isn't the Lucid interview as much as I'm interested in these things. So tell me a little bit about your time working in a startup. You said when you got started there, you did client services. And so what I mean by that, I assume by that is you were a consultancy. People hired you to build products for them. So I have a couple questions. The first question I want to ask is, what changes happened to your tech stack over the years? When did you come across Laravel? And what aspects of Laravel made you most interested in using Laravel when you decided to use it?
I first started using Laravel when it was Laravel 3, version 3.
That's been a while, man.
And yeah, that's a long while. And what's interesting is that the project that we built back then was shut down a few months ago. So it was still running until today.
Nice. That's great.
That's what makes it, yeah, makes it very interesting. The thing that got me about Laravel was, I can easily say it's the documentation at the beginning. I mean, when you read the documentation, you literally understand how you would how much potential this framework has, and how much you can open up and build on top of that. And it's easy to start with. So we started this project. It took us 2 or 3 months, and we were up with an administration interface for multiple websites that we had for different clients. And that was when we first started Laravel. The tech stack back then was Laravel, MySQL database, with a regular Apache web server. And later on, we had this project where it was a publishing platform. This was the first pivot in the business model. So we started, we stopped doing services, and then we shifted into building our publishing platform. And with that, there was also ideas about user-generated content and actions that users can take on content published by celebrities. So from our services that we've done, we've built a lot of, we've built a huge network of celebrities that are A-class in our region. And from there, we thought, let's build a platform and join them all together where they can have official news and posts that can also integrate with social media and have people join that platform as well. And this is where the first search for a database that can really mimic what the social network would be in data. And that was where we discovered Neo4j, and this is where we started building NeoAlcuin so that we can build that platform. And we did for a while, and then we figured, that's not really the gap in the business. We were just doing that so that we, because we thought it was the point of entry into the entertainment business. But then we also pivoted that into a SaaS, a platform where we can gather data from social media, because influencer marketing is booming these days, right? And especially in the region, it came a little late than we predicted. So we knew this was coming very soon, and we thought, why not build a platform that can bridge all of this? And this is, this was the second shift. And this was also the shift from a monolith, a single application, single code base, into microservices, which is a was a completely different set of challenges that we were facing. Challenges that we never, things that we've took for granted, like networks and connections and discovery, services knowing about each other and communicating between applications. This was taken for granted in a monolith because you don't really have these problems. But once we've shifted to microservices, a huge new set of challenges just popped up, and we never thought we would have these. But and we had a lot of trouble getting around with these tools because we were not experienced in that area. So we had to learn a lot before we could do it as we do it today. I wouldn't say it's the right way. We're doing it and it's working.
Yeah,
right?
I hear that. We're getting close to time, and I want to make sure that I've asked all the questions I had. Oh, tell me a little about Lebanon, and tell me a little bit about Lebanon as a developer, and tell me a little bit about Lebanon as a Laravel developer.
All right. So Lebanon, in general, is this small country that you can barely see on the map, let alone Beirut, if you were able to spot that on the map. So it's a very small country, but it's faced a lot of political stuff happening, going around, wars and internal civil wars, and then people not liking each other politically, etc. So this is all going on. Even though all of this is happening, the tech community managed to, well, the startup and entrepreneurship communities managed to rise from all of this that was happening. There are certain areas in Beirut where they are dedicated to provide as much as they can, have the amenities to run any idea you have. Like that you can rent just like any accelerator or an incubator program. There's plenty of these here today, where you can rent a small desk and do whatever you have to do from there. Internet connection was a huge problem. It's becoming much better nowadays. I mean, if this was to happen a couple of years ago, we maybe couldn't have done this at all.
Yeah.
Due to the internet connection. But nowadays, it's become much, much different. As a developer, there's plenty of talent in here. We enjoy sharing the knowledge, sharing everything we can get from abroad and from here, from each other. The only problem is that there isn't much people in here.
Yeah.
So everyone, which is, I mean, it's a double-edged sword, right?
Right.
Everyone knows everybody, but it's the same people that you always see in all the events. You don't really get to, you know, these networking time that you get in conferences?
You know everybody
already.
We
don't really get to network. yeah, we know each other.
That's funny.
So, we try to go abroad for these more than doing it local.
Got it.
But at the same time, when we were first starting, there was no community, right? We did not feel that there's this connection, this circle of people that are trying to build something together, build a hub of knowledge, hub of experience that they can share among each other. Mm-hmm. But now what we're trying to do is tighten and strengthen the connections between these people so that we can build a more full circle that can incubate everyone in the community as much as possible and show whoever is starting to get into the technology or development that there is a place for them here. We don't really need to go and work abroad. We can do it from here. We're trying our best to do that. As a Laravel developer, there's plenty of people who are using Laravel nowadays.
Okay.
We gather, we talk a lot about what we do differently in Laravel, and we talk a lot about how eloquent it is in the way
it's
exactly. and the way we can write code, and we exchange a lot. We try to provide a lot of open source to each other, open source libraries, and tell each other, well, I've written this small script, why don't you use it?
Oh,
you
cool.
Because we know each other, we know what we're working on, right? So if we find a common interest, one of us would contribute that and provide it to the rest. So it's a very small community, I'd say. But it's very interesting because it's still sustaining. For almost 6 years now, it is sustaining and is growing.
That's really cool.
So I find it really cool here to have, I mean, for anyone who knows Lebanon and knows how many people there is here, to find this, that's amazing. That's all you need. You don't really need to have any much more than this. The only issue in here is scale. We cannot apply what we work on at scale.
Got it.
And we cannot scale what we work on unless it's provided internationally. And to go international from here, it is really, really tough. Unless it's a branch of an international company that is working here but provides the business from abroad, it is really not much room for you to scale compared to other places. That's the only drawback.
I did not realize how small it is, because Beirut has similar population to the very small feeling town that I live in. And I used to live in Chicago, which has, I think it's 2.5 million people, and Lebanon entirely has 6 million people. So I now understand what you're talking about scale wise.
Exactly.
Is there much of a, like, I mean, I guess, like, how far of a drive is, if I assume Beirut is kind of like the technical center. Are people coming into today, Beirut for a lot of meetups and stuff like that? Is that even that far of a drive?
It's not far. I mean, it's relatively far because of the traffic. It is way too far, man. but if you were to just measure the numbers, you would say, well, that's to you, that's not even a drive.
Right. Right?
Okay. It's just a walk.
So what's the furthest somebody comes into Beirut for a meetup or a conference who lives in Lebanon?
No, they do. Yeah, they do. They do.
What's the furthest out? Furthest drive? Is it an hour? Is it 30 minutes? Is it 5 hours? Like, what's it look like?
5 hours? No, 5 hours. You would be in a different country.
There is
no.
That's what I thought.
But it's
a couple hours.
A couple of hours drive.
Okay.
Well, what's interesting is that we have this an institution, a small institution called SE Factory, SE standing for Software Engineering Factory, which where they teach Laravel to graduating students.
Really? That's really cool.
Yeah, it is. And the more interesting thing about this is that people come to Beirut to study this on a daily basis from 9 in the morning to 7 at night and going over 2 hours drive from their country towns. It's a long drive, and you have no idea how draining to energy it is to go through all this traffic on a daily basis to be able to learn this.
I that's the first group I've ever heard of that is teaching Laravel as a part of a code school. I'll ask you for the link later, and I'll put it in the show notes for everybody. SE Factory. That's really fascinating. Okay.
It is.
I have one last question for you, and that is, what is the best book that you have ever read? Doesn't have to be about programming, book across the board.
Oh, yeah. That's a very interesting question because my favorite book is the one that was given to me by the Laravel community when I went to speak at Laracon. We had a dinner a day before that. Huh. And they gave us all books, and it was Godel Escherbach, which is the book that bridges so many topics, right? It's between art and science, mainly, and music, of course. This is a book that really manifests how I like to think about technology nowadays. It's not about just coding. It's more than that. It's about understanding, there's a lot of creativity in there to be put. There's a lot of potential and opportunity for someone to expand and to put their all into this and make something out of it. It's endless. And the way that these areas were merged together in this book is fascinating. Hmm. You just get to see that philosophy, music, and science, they're all in the same place. And how they bridge and share the same fundamentals in terms of creativity. It was very, very interesting.
I'm reading through the preview on Amazon right now, and it's definitely triggering some. I studied English literature in school. And it's definitely, there's a lot of philosophy in there, but I was as a technologist while I was there. And it's definitely just reading through some of the basic intro stuff here. I'm going, okay, this is both scary and exciting in seeing those things. But this is super intellectual though.
It is.
At least it looks like it is. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And you would feel after you've read this book, you would feel like, wow, man, that's a lot that's happening, and I'm in a field that's much bigger than I thought it was. It's not the if and else statements that I've written. It's much more than that. That's what makes it more interesting.
This is fascinating. Okay, well, I'm putting a link to the book in the show notes. It's Godel Escherbach, the Golden Braid or a Golden Braid or something like that.
Yes, an Eternal Golden Braid. Yep.
Yeah, I will link that in the show notes. Well, thank you. you know, I'm really happy. I'm very, very pleasantly surprised that it was so not a programming book, and that was really good. Well, we're past time, so I have to cut, which I hate doing, but I have to do. So if people want to follow you, or if there's any other last thing you want to shout out or something like that, how do you want people to kind of, what's their one takeaway? Should they follow you on Twitter? Should they go try out some product? What do you want them to do?
Sure. So on Twitter, that's one. On GitHub, that's two. And it's the same identity all over the place. It's Mulcave, mm-hmm. Mulkave. That's the username that I use everywhere. So if you look up Mulcave on Google, you'll get all my contact mediums and everywhere. There's also the tech blog of Vylab, where you can find the introduction to also Lucid and stuff we do at work here, which could be interesting also to look at.
Okay. And I'll link all those in the show notes. I do have to ask, what's Mulcave?
Oh, well... I told you I was into gaming when I was young, and there was this game about vampires.
Okay.
And there was this kind of clan of vampires that are intellectual. They're called the Malkavians, Malkavian. Okay. So I found the introduction of these of this clan and the people in this clan to be very... much matching my personality and character. So I thought, well, I'll just choose that. And one day I had to choose a username. So I was like, yeah, Mulcave, yeah, whatever.
Yeah. I see the best usernames are ones where you know that forever you're going to be able to get it on any social network no matter what. So I like it.
Exactly.
Awesome. Well, I really appreciate you taking your time to talk to me.
Thank you very much.
People who don't know, we had never met before, and I asked around and I said, hey, I want to meet people in different communities, and you know, so Abed was recommended to me, and we had a chat a couple weeks ago, and I said, yeah, this is definitely someone I want to talk to, and it was a total pleasure. So I really appreciate it, and thanks for your time, man.
Thank you very much for having me on this podcast, and I really appreciate your time as well. Thank you.